This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
as an outbreak of pneumonic plague worsens in Madagascar, the World Health Organization and other international agencies are working with the Ministry of Health to stop the spread of this deadly disease. Latest official figures put the number of cases at 231, including 33 deaths.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, political tensions continue to climb in Kenya ahead of the rerun presidential election. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that last year, more than 8,000 children were killed and injured in conflict zones.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: political tensions continue to climb in Kenya ahead of the rerun presidential election on October 26th. Opposition supporters took to the streets of major cities today to demand that electoral officials blamed for botching the first election step down immediately. Mohammed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi with reporting from Kisumu by Jill Craig.
Supporters of the ruling Jubilee Party clashed with opposition protesters in central Nairobi Friday. The Jubilee supporters say the opposition is disrupting business activities and creating tensions in the city. This Jubilee backer told VOA that we had our peaceful meeting and they started throwing stones. We shall be respected. But one opposition supporter accused Jubilee supporters of actively trying to disrupt their planned protest. He says, "We have seen traders brought here by bus to fight us. That is not right." Violence also erupted in the opposition stronghold of Kisumu. Thousands of protesters blocked roads with bonfires and threw rocks, paralyzing business activities. Police fired tear gas to repel some demonstrators, looting a retail store, and made some arrests. Kisumu is the hometown of opposition leader and presidential candidate Raila Odinga. The opposition is demanding the resignation of electoral officials behind what the Supreme Court called the bungling of the August presidential vote. The court nullified the victory of incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta due to irregularities and illegalities in the transmission of election results. Kenya must hold a new presidential election by the end of this month. In Nairobi Friday, the Kisumu County Women's Representative, Rosa Buyu, was among the hundreds of opposition demonstrators who marched to the headquarters of the Electoral Commission, or IEBC, which was under heavy guard by riot police.
We are here to demonstrate peacefully, to show displeasure with the slow pace with which IEBC is pretending to carry out reforms. We are saying, if there are no reforms, then it's useless to go for this election.
The IEBC officials have denied any wrongdoing and have refused to resign. Meanwhile, the Jubilee Party has set out to change the electoral law. The proposed changes include prioritising the use of manual transmission of results over the electoral transmission and giving the other IEBC commissioners power to announce the presidential results in the event the chairman gets sick or resigns. The chairman of the commission, Wafula Chebukati, said if the proposed changes are passed, it will be difficult to have an election on the 26th.
All that will fundamentally change what we are doing. Then we say we shall have a problem with that kind of law, because to implement it would be an issue. And that's why we said we, as a commission, we are ready for elections.
Legal experts warn Kenya may be headed for a constitutional crisis if the IEBC fails to conduct an election by the court's October 30th deadline. Kenya's Attorney General has said President Uhuru Kenyatta will remain in office until the next president is sworn in. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
We'll be right back. As an outbreak of pneumonic plague worsens in Madagascar, the World Health Organization and other international agencies are working with the Ministry of Health to stop the spread of this deadly disease. Latest official figures put the number of cases at 231, including 33 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Pneumonic plague is a lung infection transmitted through flea bites or from person to person through droplets in the air when someone coughs or sneezes. A person can die within 48 hours of the disease's onset if not treated with antibiotics. In response to this crisis, a spokesman for the World Health Organization, Tarek Jazarevich, says the WHO sent 1.2 million doses of antibiotics to Madagascar this week.
These antibiotics are being given to health facilities, and they are enough to treat 5,000 patients and protect up to 100,000 people who may have been exposed to disease. We are also feeling critical shortages in disinfection materials and personal protective equipment for health professionals and safe burials.
While plague is a recurring problem in Madagascar, this particular outbreak has triggered a nationwide panic because it has moved from remote rural areas into the cities, including the capital, Antananarivo. To contain the spread, the International Red Cross Federation is releasing emergency funds to support the Malagasy Red Cross, which is mobilizing more than 700 community volunteers in response to the outbreak. The Red Cross Director of Healthcare, Julie Hall, says the volunteers will scale up community surveillance and contact tracing and tell their communities about steps they must take to protect themselves.
So getting the messages out into the communities that treatment is available, that treatment is possible, but you need to receive the antibiotics as quickly as possible after developing symptoms is vital. In addition to that, if someone has had contact, close contact with someone with the symptoms, it's vital that they get the antibiotics as quickly as possible because that can stop them developing any symptoms.
Symptoms of pneumonic plague include coughing, fever, chest pain, and trouble breathing. Despite the gravity of the outbreak, the World Health Organization does not advise any travel or trade restrictions on Madagascar. The agency, however, says travelers should inform themselves about the disease, and if they have any symptoms, go to the nearest health facility immediately. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In his annual report on children and armed conflict, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that last year more than 8,000 children were killed and injured in conflict zones and urged combatants to do more to protect boys and girls. In Somalia and Syria, Guterres said the recruitment and use of children has doubled since 2015. The report says the UN has verified 169 incidents affecting at least 1,022 youngsters in South Sudan. According to the report, 60% of them were recruited and used by government security forces. The Secretary General also pointed in his annual address the number of violations committed against children by extremist groups. He said Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, the Islamic State, and the Taliban have committed gross violations on more than 6,000 children. The Secretary General's report this year mentioned that the Saudi-led coalition fighting Houthi rebels in Yemen is taking steps to reduce child casualties. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, and at 14 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Political tensions continue to climb in Kenya ahead of the rerun presidential election on October 26th. International agencies are working with the government of Madagascar to stop the spread of the deadly pneumonic plague. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says that more than 800 children were killed and injured last year in conflict zones. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The Associated Press and Reuters reported yesterday that President Donald Trump's administration is expected to permanently lift decades-long sanctions on Sudan. Although the announcement is a few days before next week's deadline, Suleiman Baldo, a senior advisor at the Enough Project, tells reporter Ayen Bior the move by the White House has been widely predicted for months.
This is not a surprising. It was an expected development. Given that the U.S. and Sudan have been engaged in a strategic dialogue under which President Obama, in his very last week in power, lifted sanctions from Sudan conditionally and for a test period of 6 months, a policy that has been followed by President Trump, who extended that period by 3 months. And it was clearly expected that Sudan, according to assessment of the U.S. administration, has met the condition of making of the lifting of the sanctions a permanent decision, which is now expected for today.
Human rights activists and Sudan observers, many of whom I've talked to, are not happy with the potential lifting of sanctions, saying the Sudan government has not made progress in respecting human rights in places like Darfur, as you mentioned, or South Kordofan. What do you make of that argument?
It is true that the decision by the Obama administration, which became also the policy under President Trump, was very lenient with regard to the five tracks policy, the five areas of conduct where Sudan has to show improvements. This included reduction of violence in conflict areas of the country, improving humanitarian access to these areas, And these are only the two conditions concerning domestic conditions in the country. The others are regional and international. Better cooperation between Sudan and the U.S. in countering international terrorism, and Sudan abstaining from interfering with the peace process in South Sudan or in supporting the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda. Therefore, conditions relating to the continued armed conflict in the country and the continuous violations of the fundamental rights of the Sudanese people were not among these five.
Why weren't they included? It seems like a very important factor to wage in.
Well, I believe the reason is that the U.S. was keen on continued cooperation between Sudan and the intelligence community in the United States sharing information about international terrorism. Sudan is able to share such information because of its history of hosting international terrorist organizations, but also because it's accommodating and allowing groups that propagate the ideology of the likes of the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in Sudan. And it justifies that by telling the U.S. administration and its partners in the West, in the intelligence community, that it's important to allow this group to function so that we can infiltrate them and give you information that is actionable on their activities.
Help us understand what happens if the sanctions are indeed lifted. What are the positive and negative effects of this decision?
I don't expect short-term improvements because the Sudanese economy is in very bad shape. There's a very serious problem of mismanagement of the national economy, of official corruption that is officially protected from the top of the authority, and therefore there will be improvement in the Sudanese economy, but not sufficiently important to really change the fundamentals and the situation of the internal economic crisis unless the government introduces serious and meaningful reforms to address corruption, to improve management, to invest in the sectors of agriculture.
That was Suleiman Baldo, a senior advisor to the Enough Project, speaking to Ayen Bior from New Jersey.
The International Monetary Fund, IMF, has stepped up in helping Somalia with a grant to print new currency before the end of this year. In an exclusive interview with VOA Somali Service, Abdirahman Duel Bili, Somalia's Minister of Finance, said the Somali government needs $100 million, half of which will directly go towards printing the new money, and an equal amount to keep the value of the currency when it circulates. The IMF grant will help the Somali government meet these needs. The finance minister said Somalia's old currency has almost disappeared and had been replaced by U.S. dollars or privately printed notes, most of which are worthless fakes. The government plans to issue both coins and paper money. It plans to print several billion shillings before the end of the year.
More than 18,000 women in the technology industry gathered in Orlando, Florida this week at the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing. VOA's Silicon Valley editor Michelle Quinn was there and talks to Kate Pound Dawson about a key concern for the tech industry, how to draw more women into its ranks. Women now make up only about 20% of the technology industry workforce.
What are you seeing regarding education for girls in technology and science? Was there a lot of emphasis at the convention on education?
There really was. I mean, it started right at the beginning. Melinda Gates, who's co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, was the keynote speaker. And she talked about the pipeline. The pipeline in tech has always meant, why aren't there more girls signing up for computer science classes? Or why do girls drop out of math? And she had a different vision that she presented, which was that there shouldn't be just one pipeline, and that in a way the tech industry has made a mistake all these years by allowing people just to self-select. You know, if you manage to get through math and then you get to the university and you start taking computer science, then you get pushed, you have a track and you follow the track, and that women fall off of it. And her idea, which I really liked, was maybe what should happen is multiple pipelines, multiple entry points into the tech industry. Maybe start from the beginning, require computer science for all ninth graders in high school or even earlier, and then add computer technology and programming at various points in a person's career development so that they can jump in, so that there's like multiple pipelines coming in and that tech doesn't miss out on this great talent, particularly women's talent.
What are you seeing in terms of career opportunities for women now? Is there a shift? Is there a sense that the field is beginning to open up?
I talk to women at the convention, and there really is. I mean, I think there's a sense that this is their time. There were sessions on, you know, everything about how to get a job, to how to present yourself, specifically for maybe students trying to enter the workforce. I think the thing that I heard over and over again was that women, students and women who are interested in the field really need mentors, allies, people, other women to kind of help them kind of get through, and men as well, to kind of help them kind of get through maybe some of the challenges of the industry. So the tech industry started a couple of years ago publishing the data on its demographics of its workforce, and it hasn't seemed to stop from that. So I think that data has put a spotlight on the issue, and companies, you know, report, celebrate when they go up 1% in female hires, you know, at the same time saying we're not doing enough, we need to do more. But I think companies and universities, I think, are continually looking at this question and working hard at it. So I think this is a really great time for women, and particularly when it comes to technology.
That was Michelle Quinn, VOA's Silicon Valley editor, speaking with Kate Pound Dawson from the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing in Orlando, Florida.
In Malawi, superstition and public panic are driving a recent spate of killings in the southern district of Mulanje, Tiolo, and Sanje, Over the past few weeks, vigilantes have killed 7 people who were accused of draining blood from others. Police have increased their presence in the region to prevent more killings. Lamik Masina reports from Blantyre.
About 2 weeks ago, stories about the presence of what are called bloodsuckers spread rapidly in southern Malawi. Residents say the bloodsuckers use magical powers to immobilize victims late at night with a chemical, then drain their blood before vanishing. Police and traditional leaders dismiss the stories as the work of ill-intentioned people who wanted to bring chaos in the community. James Kadadzela is the National Police spokesperson.
Since this issue started, nobody has come in the open to say that there was the attack or was the fact of his blood. And even the hospital officials have not certified that anybody has been attacked. As the police, we are saying that this is a rumor.
However, residents are now attacking anyone they suspect of being a bloodsucker. The most recent attack happened on Sunday in Mulanje district when an angry mob beat 2 people to death. Also on Sunday, another mob touched the house of a businessman in Cholo district. And also a local chief was killed 2 weeks ago in Insanje district by a group who accused him of being involved in the supernatural. Kadadzela said about 17 people have been arrested in connection to the killings. The vigilante risk is so high. The U.S. Embassy in Malawi has temporarily barred staff from going to the affected districts and pulled out Peace Corps workers. The vigilantes alarmed chiefs in some areas. Aida Deleza is the senior chief in Chikumbu area in Mulanje district.
We are living in fear. We are afraid to be attacked. Myself alone, I can't stand with a group of men and boys. I can't.
Some local aid groups have halted their activities in the districts to protect their workers. The Minister of Civic Education and Culture is organizing programs to encourage respect for the rule of law and to combat the rumors of bloodsuckers. Stories of strangers moving around villages looking for blood for ritual purposes regularly flare up in Malawi. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Vasco Volarich, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.